Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a walk to the place where a man may stand and put all America behind him.
Yeah, we can go down to the beach.
Sure, let's do that. Well, a hat tip to Henry David Thoreau, of course, and his beautiful observation about Cape Cod. Because it was Thoreau's words that bounded through my mind as I walked along Coast Guard Beach in Eastham with writer Robert Finch.
Well, the reason why I wanted to come down to the beach is, of course, the title of your book is The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. Can we walk in a bit and talk?
Sure. You can't walk 1,000 miles.
No. Maybe half a mile, quarter mile?
Sure.
Okay.
Into the wind.
We walk into the wind. Finch has walked the outer beach for more than 50 years, and on this day, it's at high tide. The sky is blue-gray. The water is gray-green. The surf is kicking up whitecaps, a restless herd of watery wild horses. A nor'easter is on the way.
What about the beach makes it special to you?
Well, that's what all my writing for the last half century has been about. I always compare it to falling in love with someone. You have this passion to know them. You want to find out every possible thing about them that you can. At the same time, you hope you never will, that sense of mystery will remain. And I think that's been the case with me. I was just fascinated by it, I suppose, in a sensory manner. It's human scale. The whole Cape, to me, has a scale that reminds me of my own humanity. Mm-hmm. On the beach, it's the element of change. Change happens here on a scale that is close to what happens to change in my own life, and I associated with it that way. And that's really what's kept me here, I think. This sense that there's something non-human out there that I find parallels with in my own life, and I try to articulate that.
Can we walk a little bit more?
Sure, of course. The metaphor that most writers use to talk about what's happening out here is war or struggle between land and sea. That's a very human imposed metaphor. And I don't think it really, and I've used it myself. It's just an easy one to come up to. Particularly after a very destructive storm, you just want to compare that landscape to a war site where everything looks freshly destroyed. But it's not. I think if you're going to continue to use human metaphors, it's more of a dance between the ocean and the land. And I think I say somewhere in one of the books that the ocean must, in a way, love the land that it takes because it's given to it so freely, so easily. So I'm going to have to come up with a better word than reclaim, because the ocean never owned it, but it's taking it now.
But you know, it makes sense to me why writers and people just intuitively use, as you said, those very human metaphors.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for the blink of an eye, in terms of the arc of time that this area has existed in, yeah, we're just occupying
the
tiniest blink of an
yeah
eye. But to us, it does seem like there's a constant battle, even though, I mean, we're the interlopers.
Right. Yeah.
Because we're bad. I mean, like, right now, so many of the daily stories coming out of the Cape is people literally battling to save their own.
Well, that's one of the things that's always fascinated me about the beach. I think what the core of my interest comes from, not just from the natural landscape itself, but how people interact with it and how they respond to what it does. And again, probably one of the more dramatic examples of that is how people respond to erosion. Now, if you're just like us today, a visitor to the beach, this is all very fascinating and beautiful and dramatic to watch this. But if you own a beach cottage or a house on one of these bluffs, and you know that the ocean is going to take your land, surely, with its power of eminent domain, it fascinates me how people respond to that. A lot of people, most people I would say, who have cottages on the beach or modest houses, accept it. They recognize that their time here on the beach is limited. But there is still this attitude among some people that we ought to be able to beat the ocean. We ought to be able to, you know, be a permanent fixture here and not have to give in to the inevitable. But they're wrong.
You talk about the many lessons you've learned walking these beaches. I mean, has the beach, has the Cape been a teacher to you?
Well, I have one essay in the book where I walk the beach with a friend who's come down from the hills of Vermont, and his life is undergoing some problematic changes, and he's looking for reassurance. And I realize that by living here on the beach, if there's a lesson, the lesson has been how to live with change. Change is inevitable. You have to accept it. You have to adapt to it and rethink your whole position. If you live in a place for a long enough time, it begins to shape your attitudes. It gives you, as I say, those images, those metaphors, those tropes that you can find useful in your own life.
So how have you changed? How has it shaped you?
Oh, my. I suppose as I get older, what the beach says to me more now than it said before is a lesson in mortality. You have to just sort of accept that that's part of the change is part of the nature of life, and death is part of the nature of life. I don't want to sound too somber about that. I guess that's one of the paradoxes I find on the beach too. The beach is inhabited by organisms that are generally extremely fragile. A good example of that being these shorebird nesting areas. Especially the tiny piping plovers. Which nest right out here on the beach, and very often a storm in the middle of their nesting season will just wipe out the entire colony, and they go right back to nesting again.
Yeah.
So they're at once fragile and very enduring. And that seems to be innate in the nature of the beast, of the beach, that it harbors conflicting elements. It's constantly creating beauty, and it's constantly destroying it at the same time.
Do you love the beach? Do you love the Cape in the same way that you did when you first came here?
Oh, of course it's changed. Again, the metaphor that always comes to fore is marriage. You know, marriage initially is an experience of possession and discovery. And after a time, it becomes something, well, I was going to say less dramatic, but more deeply satisfying. But I have to be careful about that, because just when I think that the novelty of the beach has worn off, I've seen everything that there is to see, the beach will do something to disprove me of the beach. No, I think I can't imagine living anywhere else, let's put it that way. I've grown, I don't want to use the word comfortable, but I've reached a rapport with the beach that I'm pleased, it pleases me.
To be in conversation with sand and surf for 50 years, honestly, I'm jealous of the soulful rapport Robert Finch has had with the Outer Beach. Can the young and distracted slow themselves, steady their gaze, and listen deeply enough to fall in love the way Finch did all those years ago? Maybe, the ocean seems to shrug. So I ask Robert Finch to inspire us a bit more. He reads the essay from his book about his first contact with the Cape a half century ago.
The first time I ever saw the Outer Beach was in the spring of 1962, April, I think, when I was 19. My freshman roommate at Harvard was John Hagenbuckle, whose father ran one of the dozen or so sailing camps that dotted the inner shores of Pleasant Bay in those days. It was not the first time I had seen the ocean. Growing up in urban New Jersey, I went with my family on one or two excursions to Asbury Park. And I have a memory, when I was about 5, of standing in the waves, which were as tall as I was then, and of being lifted by them, gently and with a sense of benignity. But we were mostly lake people in the summers, and after our family moved to West Virginia when I was 12, I did not see the ocean again until that spring on Cape Cod, 7 years later. John and I left Cambridge sometime after 11 at night, driving in his old VW Bug. There was a full moon and no other traffic on Route 3 for most of the way down. Somewhere around Plymouth, having seen no other cars for a while, John turned off the headlights and we drove for several miles by the light of the moon. It was like entering another world. We stayed that night in one of the camp cottages in South Orleans. The next day, a late spring northeaster strafed the land, whipping up a wild surf that assaulted the beach. We drove out to Nauset Beach, buttoned up in the foul weather gear that John had provided, and shouldered our way against the wind and rain out of the parking lot and through a gap in the dunes. When I first beheld that wild beach, it overwhelmed whatever anticipations or expectations I might have had. My reaction totally surprised me and was, at the time, inexplicable. I turned full front to the ocean, raised both my arms, and began to conduct. I waved my arms out and in, up and down, in rough time to the surf's irregular rhythm. Of course, I was conducting nothing. Even then, I felt that the ocean was something that took absolutely no cognizance of me. If anything, it was I who was being conducted by the sea, trying to catch its rhythms and tempi, trying awkwardly to become a part of its overwhelming majesty. Now, at a distance of more than 5 decades, my reaction seems understandable, even predictable. The only thing in my life thus far that was at all commensurate to what I was experiencing on that beach was symphonic music, mostly the Romantics. Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Dvorak, and Sibelius, especially Sibelius. I had spent much of my adolescent years in West Virginia in our family's darkened pine-paneled basement rec room, listening to 33 and a third LPs of those composers on my Motorola portable stereo with detachable speakers. It was my drug of choice in those pre-drug days, my substitute for sex in those pre-sex days. I would often stand in front of the turntable conducting the music in the dark as a way of becoming part of it. It called forth a depth of emotional and psychic response unlike any I had ever experienced or would until that day on the beach. Like the music, but of vastly larger proportions, the storm waves gave me the sense of illimitable power and irresistible force, of lavish, inexhaustible beauty, a mixture of desire and fear, all held within laws, patterns, and a sense of order too vast and complex for my adolescent mind to recognize, let alone understand, but which I nevertheless felt deeply. I stood on the brink of something that could, if I overstepped my bounds, swallow me up instantly, annihilate me utterly, but which, if I showed the proper respect, caution, and patience, might tolerate me, not shut me out, and perhaps eventually might even allow me an audience with his august presence. My awkward attempts at conducting, I can now see, were unconscious and instinctive, an homage, a recognition of a power I had never encountered before, and a desire to somehow be a part of it.
Robert Finch, reading his essay, First Contact. It's part of his new book, The Outer Beach, a 1,000-mile walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic shore. We walked with Robert along Coast Guard Beach in East Ham. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.